This episode of The Drunken Odyssey is brought to you by Scribophile, an online community with thousands of serious writers working in every conceivable genre. If you're eager to improve your own work and network with others, Scribophile is for you. Scribophile has educational tutorials, exciting forums, and most importantly, the ability to exchange in-depth critiques with other writers, using a karma system that keeps the exchange fair and equal. What is most exciting to me is that Scribophile allows writers to critique novel chapters, which is not something a writer can be guaranteed to experience in an MFA program. A basic account is free and grants you all the features, but upgrading to a premium account allows you to gain access to posting numerous works at once, requires no additional karma points to enter contests, and other special features for only $9 a month or $65 a year. That's a lot less than a Netflix subscription. Listeners of The Drunken Odyssey will receive a 20% discount on top of those already low rates. Check out this week's show notes for details.
Myself is a self divided, shaken from its core, its essence, an association of parts asserting wholeness a while, if feebly. Like Spinoza says, every body is made up of multiple smaller bodies. When these smaller bodies share an intention through time and space, they become a larger body. This goes on ad infinitum in both directions. But myself has of late been coming apart. My left foot was lost somewhere between Amarillo and Santa Fe while I was on a road trip about a year ago. I dropped my cell phone in the most terrifying public toilet I'd ever seen, out behind a gas station on Highway 24. I left it there, of course. I left several hairs on my pillow last night. Lost a toenail, other foot, while backpacking on the Colorado Trail. There are a number of songs that I wrote back when I used to do that kind of thing that are gone now. I've lost the words. I've lost the chords. I lost both lips one night in high school when I stayed out way past curfew with a group of friends who, a few weeks later, would no longer be my friends. In fact, I've lost a lot of friends over the years. I've lost two entire libraries on two separate occasions. I think I've lost my liver. I don't know what happened to it. I'm pretty sure I had one, and now I'm pretty sure it's gone. I lost a tooth in a bicycle accident. I've lost several pets. I've lost my voice, my spouse, my pea coat, and several pairs of sunglasses. When I look at myself in the mirror, I see mutiny. I see chaos, soldiers abandoning their posts and running blindly off into the smoky woods.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my friends, to episode 523. On today's show, I talk to Aaron Angelo about his wonderful book of early morning musings on Shakespeare's sonnet number 29. Dig it, listeners. When in disgrace, with fortune in men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state, and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries, and look upon myself and curse my fate, wishing me like to one more rich in hope, featured like him with friends possessed, desiring this man's art and that man's scope, with what I most enjoy contented least. Yet in these thoughts myself almost despising, haply I think on thee, and then my state, like to the lark at break of day arising from sullen earth, sings hymns at heaven's gate. For thy sweet love remembered such wealth brings, that I then scorn to change my state with kings. Which is more or less how I feel about you, dear listeners. There's kind of an accidental pun at the end of that sonnet when I read it, and for that I to apologize. So I've been having rather a hard time here at the secret headquarters of the Drunken Odyssey. I'm kind of battling three medical problems all at once, and the one that was kind of quiet got noisy last night. So some of the profound musings that I've had on my mind aren't really going to happen this week. I didn't get much sleep, and I'm kind of, got this headache that's medicated, but more or less makes me feel like I am trying to think like passing a bowling ball through the fabric of pantyhose. Why somebody would be doing that is beyond me. But I am cheered that there is a new Greg Proops album out. Greg and I are friendly, and he appeared a long time ago on my show. And it's just always great, the performers you love, when there's new work to be added to the canon. So In the City features over an hour of comedy straight out of San Francisco. I'm also incredibly enthused by the new album by Jack White called Fear of the Dawn. So I recommend those two new albums. They've been a great consolation in the phantasmagorias of my dyspeptitude and... Alright, I think I'll just stop inventing words. And let us get to my wonderful talk with Aaron Angelo.
And now, the interview of the day.
My guest today, Aaron Angelo, wrote The Fact of Memory while working in a hard academic field and ended up being invited into an MFA workshop that was unusual that let him reconnect to his creative life, and maybe it saved his life just a little bit. And the lyric essays or prose poems, I guess we could talk about the nature of what do we call these, we could discuss, is just a remarkable book. And I don't know, I don't like to think that I'm sentimental, or maybe it's just I'm your perfect niche audience, but this just jabbed me right in the fucking heart.
It's good.
Thank you for writing this book and for taking the time to take this, right? This was a creative exercise that you did over a significant period of time.
Yeah.
Turned it into a finished product, which I'm not sure that was necessarily what you were expecting when you embarked on it. So what was it you were working on academically at the time?
I was writing my dissertation at the time. So I was finishing up my PhD and I was writing a dissertation on glitch and error in digital media or even analog media as a sort of compositional approach to writing. And honestly, that was about 6 years ago. And I would be hard pressed to really talk to you intelligently about anything I was writing at the time.
Well, actually, it sounds interesting. And it sounds like maybe the mistake is maybe one of the most interesting points in work that might be too glossy or overproduced, or
absolutely. And I was writing about digital media and the way some digital poets. There's a poet named Talon Mehmet who wrote a piece called Lexia to Perplexia in the 90s, and it was for, like, I think it was meant to be read and viewed on a Apple IIe or something. Maybe it was a little later than that.
I actually had one of those.
Yeah, I worked at the Media Archaeology Lab in Colorado, and it was really fun. A lot of those old machines that still work.
The monitor was very green.
Yeah, very green, very green.
Green on green.
I'm pretty sure, actually, that the Lexia to Perplexia was a little bit later than that, because it was an internet-based piece. But nonetheless, it was one of the things that he did is he kind of wrote its ephemerality into it. He talked about how, you know, when you're writing in that medium, you know that it's going to go away. And there's a kind of an awareness of the fact that this stuff isn't permanent and it shouldn't be. And so it's part of the poetics of the piece is that it's going to disappear someday. So that was the kind of stuff I was working on at the time.
So you do remember, kind of.
Kind of. Yeah. The thing that it did for sure for me was the kind of theoretical stuff I was looking at and thinking about. I don't even know how, if it's theoretical or if it's more, you know, metaphysical or something, but I really started thinking about creativity and how we access our creativity and how we sort of get to go to those places where we do original work. In our case, we write, but you know, other people maybe paint or write music or invent things or come up with, you know, new ways of socially interacting with each other, or whatever the case may be. But the kind of stuff I was looking at, I was always really interested in ways that creative people were bumped out of their sort of conscious mind into a creative place. That's what my academic work, when I was doing that, that's what that was all about.
Well, I think there is this fundamental tension in creative writing or storytelling. Mm-hmm. I guess there are other forms of creative writing that don't necessarily tell stories, but to tell a story, you have to have a form that an audience can recognize without too much struggle.
Yeah.
And that's part of the appeal of storytelling is, okay, I get that. I see the structure, or at least something of a structure in what you're doing. And now I'm going to kind of assess, you know, what you're doing with those materials while hopefully also enjoying it as a story. Mm-hmm. And yet that can be a form of creative death if the structure is too prominent. If you think, wow, I'm watching a Western and they sure are doing Western stuff, then you're not really paying attention to the story, so that you have to be partly aware and partly amnesiac about watching a Western if you're actually going to get engaged with the story. And I think that with long form storytelling, especially, that's a huge tension to try and masterfully balance right through, you know, a whole lot of words. And so I guess that is similar to the despair one feels deep in a dissertation where you're like, okay, I thought I knew what I was doing when I started, and now, now my teachers aren't talking to me, and I have to come up with like another chapter or two at a conclusion, and I really just need to be done yesterday because this is kicking my ass, and I
That's
not enjoying this anymore, and I'm not sure I'm learning anything anymore either, other than existential horror. At
I'm so glad that you have that experience, John, because I just relate to that so much.
Well, part of it is you become an orphan, right? Like you've got the team that's going to read your dissertation and then assess it and eventually give their stamp of approval if you can stay sane enough to finish the work. Mm-hmm. But part of their job is to not help after a certain point.
Well, sure. But I also think like when someone's writing a dissertation, there comes a point when they know more about what they're writing than most other people, really. Because it's usually such a niche thing. And you probably are more equipped to talk about it than your advisors on your dissertation. That was not probably the case, and probably not my case. But I think a lot of people, they become so expert in what they're looking at that at a certain point, you just have to do it.
What I felt reading The Fact of Memory. Okay, so we should probably say what your project was.
Yeah.
So you took a Shakespearean sonnet. Mm-hmm. And you got up at 5 a.m. And so that's some major stunt work right there. Hats off to you. I did it to finish my novel and it was necessary, but man, did that suck. But Sonnet 29, which isn't like, it's not one of the more famous of his sonnets. Mm-hmm. And so you just took each word separately and, to borrow a word from the subtitle of the book, you ruminated on that one word and kind of produced a short lyric essay or prose poem. And I think not categorizing it, it was probably part of the joy of just trying to get to that creative moment. Like, okay, what substantial anything happens to me when I look at that one word in isolation?
Yes, I did that. I had a 6x9 inch sketchpad. I wrote each word in the sonnet. There are 114 words in the sonnet, and I wrote one on the top of each page in order. And that's, I sort of went through in order. And each morning, like you said, I get up at 5 a.m, which was insane. But a lot of people get a lot of good work done when they do that. It's just, it's one of those things that it's like a kind of like truth that we all know. But anyway, I did that, and I got up, and I would sit in the same chair in the same place by the same window. And of course, every day was a little different. In a way, it was a little bit of an act of you know, mindfulness or something. Mm-hmm. But I would look at whichever word was the next word that came up on the list. And I just think about it, ruminate, meditate, see what happened. And then my constraint was I had to fill up the entire page with prose and I couldn't go on to the next page. And so occasionally that was difficult. And I sort of found myself pushing just to fill up the page. But I think what's interesting is when you force yourself to do that, often you sort of push yourself into areas that are much more interesting. When I was editing, I a lot of what I edited out was the first part of what I was writing. you get to the good stuff.
When the more obvious thoughts that came out first, like, exactly. Let's dispense with those. Like, there's nothing wrong with them, but there's not enough right with them to keep them in.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. And I did that for 114 days. And then of course, over the course of years, this was 6 or 7 years ago, I've edited and reworked and jettisoned pieces and then did the process again to rewrite them. And when I started working with Abby and Kathleen at Rose Metal, they were awesome helping me sort of rethink the whole piece, the piece as a whole, and thinking about how the pieces sort of related to each other. Because I didn't think about that when I was writing. I didn't think at all about the relationship of the individual pieces to each other. Just it was just one word at a time.
Well, and the editor in me deeply appreciates the effort to both respect the, right? I mean, it seems like the goal was to regain a sense of pure creativity or something close to that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the words of the sonnet gave you your form, but you're trying to just be generative and exciting and really creative. And that really comes through. But if you just gave us the raw product, you know, if you followed the Jack Kerouac principle of first thought, best thought, mm-hmm. You're great, but some editing would really, really, really help sometimes.
Absolutely.
There are passages that I wouldn't want to touch, and then there are other passages. I'm like, maybe we don't need these 3 pages, Jack.
Yeah, exactly. That's right.
And so that editing impulse, I think, is also really important. And so there's that artificial thing that happened that just leaves kind of the best, most creative part so that it is this slightly processed record of your morning ruminations.
Yeah.
That hopefully, like, there's still the traces there of the original sort of experience, but also you leave out the boring parts.
Yeah. That's where good writing happens. Is there's two different processes that happen. There's that, I mean, this is all semantics and metaphor and stuff, but the creative process, I think, is getting out of that little limited conscious linguistic mind into something else. And however you do that, well, there's probably ways that aren't great to do that. But for me, it was just taking the time and thinking about the word and doing the daily practice and writing. And then the processes of revision and all that kind of stuff, that's where you turn writing into readable stuff. but I think both parts are crucial to doing interesting work.
Though the constraint of I'm not going to go past one page is also interesting, almost like you're like, okay, this is not going to be longer than an unpacked sonnet. Mm. And yeah. Like that's part of the joy of the sonnet, right? Is, you know, it's kind of a stunt. Okay, like we have all of these ridiculous constraints, plus I'm going to say something profound and memorable. And it's like, so you're going to rhyme an iambic pentameter and
14 lines and that's it.
And you're going to not just go lottie, 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 but you're actually going to communicate.
That's true. But I tell you, some of those days, my handwriting got really small and I started like going in circles around the margins and I was writing on every piece of white space on that paper.
A literal workaround.
Exactly. Yeah.
I still got white space, damn it. Okay.
I can keep writing. I'm on a roll here.
Well, and as a teacher, sometimes I will, maybe torture isn't the right word, but I will persuade students to do some writing right then and there. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I get resistance from that. And I'm like, you're sure the ideas are going to be so much better when you're home alone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, I think part of being an experienced writer is letting the work be bad.
Absolutely. That's
in order to let the work be before you even start figuring out having plans for the work. Just let the work be. If you've got something in there, let it out. And if you don't think you have something in there, try something. And so this was part of a workshop, right? Everyone in the workshop had to have a repeated thing that they would do every day. Mm-hmm. I guess there were no criminal charges if someone failed at that, but everyone had to make a good faith effort to get the same thing done every day.
And they did. It was really cool. It was really cool. It was a workshop with she's my dear friend now, Julie Carr. I did my MFA at the same place. And so I'd had normal workshops with her. And then this last year, my PhD, when I sat in on this other workshop, she just was trying something. And she just asked us on the first week of class to come up with something that you do every day. So people did. People would walk a certain path every single day. Or one guy was an artist and he would draw an ordinary object that was in a certain place, I think. It was just whatever it was. You did it. If I recall, Julie's daily practice was to just lie down in the park and look up at a tree. And you do this when it's snowing. This is Colorado and it's, you know, whatever. You just always do the same thing. And there's something about just creating a daily practice, the repetition, the familiar experience of doing the same thing over and over again, that I'm convinced allows us to sort of slip into a more creative space. People didn't even, in this workshop, they didn't even necessarily need to incorporate writing into their daily practice. It was just somehow supposed to influence your writing. Mine, of course, did. But it was disciplining my body in that Foucauldian sense, you know, sort of putting myself in a position where I couldn't be distracted. I've been actually talking about this a lot lately, but it's almost like putting yourself in a position where you have to become bored, where your brain can't keep being involved in trivial daily life things. You have to get to a place where you're just there. And then you can start moving away from that little conscious mind into a place beyond your consciousness.
Yeah, I'm not sure why I'm obsessed with Cy Twombly, and I really need to do more research to make sure that this story I keep telling about him isn't apocryphal, but apparently he likes to write when sometimes there's text in his paintings, but his work, it's the case where it's like, okay, my three-year-old could do that. And it's like, he couldn't make a canvas that big, but
he couldn't get up there.
But the other thing is, an adult cannot easily creatively accomplish what a really, truly young child can just do naturally.
Absolutely.
So that analogy, like, I think serious artists are going, man, I wish I could be three.
Absolutely.
And get back in and do some creative work because, you know, it's just so much more open, I think, to most, if not all, children. But yeah, so his work would be done before he's fully awake. And so that dreamy quality he has is literally because he's still kind of half in dream.
I love that. And I love Cy Twombly's work. So I didn't realize that he was sort of approaching it that way. It makes a lot of sense to me, though.
Yeah. And you look at his work and you're like, wow, it's not technically amazing, but there's something about it where it's like, I want to spend some time with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. I also love just the way Twombly's work proves the point that the formality of writing communicates a lot, I think, beyond just the sort of semantic way that language communicates. And he's sort of as extreme as you can do that. He creates these illegible poems that have maybe not sensible meaning, but experiential meaning for me.
Well, and you also mentioned in your introduction, like, okay, you picked this Shakespeare sonnet, but it could have been John Ashbery. And my ears pricked up, but I'm like, that maybe would be really challenging. I think because his poetry, I mean, you know, according to the principles of deconstruction, like, okay, all language does this, but I really think that tension between meaning and non-meaning and structure and unstructure in his work is doing this really usually graceful and interesting ballet that could be infuriating. But yeah, I would, you know, to try and do your project with an Asbury poem, I think would mean you would really have to put the blinders on and say, I'm not looking at the word on this side. I'm not looking at the word on that side. Yeah. I am only looking at this word.
Well, you know, that's kind of what I was trying to do with the sonnet, too. That's which is why I said that in the introduction. I think you could do it with an Asbury poem, or you could do it with, you know, I could just pick up a brochure to a tourist attraction or something, and I could do it with that. But I did try to really isolate each individual word. And you know, visually, that's what I had in the process, what I just had a blank page with one word on top of it. But I think what you're getting at is it's a question that a lot of people have asked me since this book has been popping around. And that is, what is the relationship to the original sonnet? And I genuinely tried not to have one, but the sonnet is always there. And especially this sonnet for me, as I think I also mentioned that in the introduction, this sonnet's been in my life forever. I memorized it when I was in middle school and I've always liked it. And so when I chose to do this project, it was just like, oh, I'll do that sonnet that I have loved forever.
It's also a case where the sonnet isn't Shakespeare being perverse. Like, if another poet wrote a sonnet like this, I wouldn't be shocked.
Right, right.
Where some of his sonnets, you're like, all right, wow, okay.
Yeah.
My love is nothing like the sun. I'm like, okay, so negging, that's what we're going with.
Right.
Renaissance negging, okay.
Yeah, it's a dark sonnet, at least the first two quatrains are. It's if you were to break it down stanza by stanza, it's basically, my life is terrible. And then part two, my life is especially terrible. And then there's the Volta, and part three is, but then there's you. And so when I think about you, you're not so bad. Or my life isn't so bad. And that's just it. But thinking about it in those terms, then I look back at what I ended up writing, which is an entirely different conversation maybe we'll get into. But like, I see so much of looking back, of finding escape from rougher things to harder times through love, through connection. You know, silly as that might seem. But that's what the sonnet's doing. And I think in a certain respect, that sort of ends up happening in the book. It wasn't something I tried to do intentionally, though.
Well, one interesting thing about the sonnet is, and elsewhere, it seems Shakespeare seems assured he's going to be famous, that he is as brilliant as he thinks he is.
Yeah, right.
But that doesn't mean that was his general treatment at the time.
Right.
And so maybe he isn't being falsely modest, and maybe he is as frustrated and as poor and as angry
as all of us
and miserable as, well, as you and me. I can't speak for everybody.
Yeah.
As students, we often come to luminaries thinking, oh, you know, everybody knew who Shakespeare was, you know, like, from before there was a Shakespeare. It's like, nope.
No.
You know, it took him a while to become like the Steven Spielberg of his day. It happened, but it wasn't necessarily easy. And he certainly had a lot of hardship and made more than, or at least his share of messes in his life, from what we know.
Sure. Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
And I also think of the piece in which you talk about how often you moved when you were a kid, and how every time you moved, you just came up with a different personality. And everyone just accepted that's who you were whenever you came up with a new one, including you. Like, no, this is the natural me, even though you just came up with radical different personas each time around, which means the personas are in some sense real, which I think also kind of means reality is kind of unreal.
Yeah, absolutely. Tying that into the title of the book, The Fact of Memory, is how we understand ourselves is, one, very subjective, changes over time, all the time. And if what we do is we remember and we create narratives to try to make sense out of our memories, then the whole thing is a creative act. Our whole beings are creative acts. It doesn't mean that there aren't real things that happen to us. I would never make that argument. But like in that piece, I was looking back and thinking of how easily it was for me to shift not just identities, but personalities, really, just by doing it and trying on different people and being different people. And I don't know, maybe we all do that all the time still. Clearly we do it in different situations. We're different personalities and different, you know, we're different people. We interact with people differently depending on who those people are. But I do think that ourselves are our creative works.
Well, I just recently showed a work of mine to a peer, mm-hmm. and he said, wow, this is a clearly a different style than you normally write in. And I thought, oh, good, I'm capable of surprising my friends.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's just a matter of when you write for a different audience. You know, if I write for a horror audience, I don't mind if literary readers come along, but it's different than when I'm writing strictly for literary readers.
Yeah, sure. And it's nice to have some freedom and understanding that you're not tied to some prescriptive, essential thing.
Well, I'd like to think, even at my advanced age of decrepitude, that I might still have things to learn about being in the world. Maybe there are some joys out there I haven't found, and maybe there's more than just sitting in this chair, grading student work and waiting to die.
I love that, and I think that's one absolutely true. Good Lord, I hope so.
Well, I mean, one of the senses I get is that this project was you performing, and I don't want to sound too new agey about it or anything, but self-care. Mm-hmm. Like, my creative self is shriveling, or it's been too long since I've been in touch with it, and no matter how creative my academic project is, it's still an academic project that has to use academic language, that has to appeal to academic readers. So at some point, I have to make sure that I pull that orphan out of the river that is my creative self so that it can keep coming along with me on the journey, even if it kind of has to keep its mouth shut when mm-hmm. I'm defending my dissertation.
Yeah, it was that for sure. And the truth is, I feel like a lot of the things I was trying to talk about in the dissertation, I just did it better in this book. Things like, you know, like it's, when Julie asked me to take part in her workshop, we were just having coffee and I just asked her for her book list because I, all through, you know, grad school, one of my things, even if I wasn't in a workshop, I always tried to buy whatever books were assigned for the workshop. And I it was just a great way to be exposed to different poets or writers. And I just asked her for that. And it was that very thing. I just was like, get me out of this world that I'm functioning in. And then she said, well, why don't you just come to the workshop? And I said, I will see you there. I will be there first thing. And it was that. It was very different.
It would be bad form for you to invite yourself into the workshop.
It would have been pretty bad. Yeah.
But once you're invited, it's like, oh, all right.
Right.
This isn't my fault at this point.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. The thing that surprised me about this book is, like I told you, I didn't look at these pieces individually. I didn't look at them as, I mean, I did look at them as individual pieces when I wrote them, and I only thought of them that way. I called this book Close Reading until I started actually putting it, like thinking of it as a book that would be published. I was just called it Close Reading. Like this. And because I was just really, it was really just about each individual word. But once I started looking at it as a collection and then working with Abby and Kathleen on it, all of a sudden it changed for me into almost a memoir or something, like a kind of fragmented autobiography with lies in it or something. Like it became something different. It became that I think that they all do something when taken together as a whole. And that shocked me. I wasn't expecting that at all. I wasn't writing that, but that's what ended up happening.
Well, there's all of these different bits of information about the places you've lived and Hollywood, LA, New York, Colorado. I know I'm missing mm-hmm. a couple.
Yeah.
But just as a reader, I'm like, okay. And I'm, you know, piecing things together. And that was part of the fun of it. One of the other weird things is if I read enough of these in a row, because mm-hmm. that is a question for the reader then, like this peculiar book in which you have these dense but incredibly readable. I'm going to call them prose poems. Is that okay?
Sure.
The book on the back says they're lyric essays, and it's like, well, if they're miniature lyric essays, then fine.
Prose
but
poems, sure.
Prose poems. So they're dense enough for me to, you know, like, okay, let me read that and let me walk around the block and then just absorb that. Mm-hmm. But if I read like five in a row, my brain has enough memory in it still to where the titles again start reforming the Shakespearean sonnet. And so this could just be a really complicated way of reading that sonnet as a reader. So that's an interesting side effect, is there's still like whispers and echoes of that sonnet bouncing around as I read this book. And I would actually have to read it out of sequence and like come up with radical ways to try and kill that off. Although I think semiotically, it's part of the fun of a project like this. Like, it's not overbearing to where I'm like, okay, this is a gimmick that just bugs me. Also, I think there's enough sorrow in here and enough coping or reckoning in this work to where the nature of the project just seems beautiful to me rather than the opposite. Now there's, because this reminds me, as a project goes, Nicholson Baker has a book called A Box of Matches. Are you familiar with it?
Mm-mm. I've read him before, but not that.
Yeah, well, I've read Vox and I've read The Mezzanine. And so The Mezzanine, it's a postmodern masterpiece. Like, he's one of the best writers. And A Box of Matches filled my heart with so much hate that I couldn't finish it. And I actually was just seething. And so every morning he would go into a room in his house and light a fire in the fireplace to get the house warmed up for the day. And then I think it was meant to record his thoughts as he was just doing this thing every day. And I hated him so much. And I'm like, he's given me so much joy as a writer. Why am I having this reaction? And I think it's just, he's living a much better life than I am. I think that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, it's like his humble brag book.
Well, it's just, here's what I'm thinking about. And I'm like, my thoughts could never be that calm or that collected or that just relaxed. Okay. It's like, no. Like, how many fires do I need to put out today? And it's like, I don't even have time to make the list because the fires are already my ears. So
now I want to read it, but I know I'm going to be entirely influenced now.
Yeah, I've probably poisoned that book, but I would read Vox if you haven't read Vox. Vox is...
It's been a while, but I did read it, but it's been years. But yeah.
So probably I need just three good nights of sleep and I would probably enjoy a box of matches. I don't know. I think one of the things that means is, you know, it's not simply, oh, someone did this project and it's like, I don't feel one way or another that someone came up with a project as a way to generate a series of texts or a collection of texts. There's something about yours in particular that really speaks to me. I do think that experienced writers don't get writer's block, though they may get writer's exhaustion. Yeah. So in your example, you know, you may think, wow, I really wish I could be more creative. What hours of the day I'm going to squeeze in to do that? What would that even look like? Like, you don't have the bandwidth or the energy to figure out how to do that until this person invites you into a workshop and you're like, okay, I can exhaust myself, but with a plan, the work will get done.
Yeah. Like, to go back to something you were saying earlier, the one thing that I'm always trying to impress upon my students is to stop thinking of what you're writing as products and just think of it as a process. And that's one of the ways to avoid writer's block. Stop thinking that what you're writing is what you're going to submit to a journal or something.
One of my students recently, I was coaching her through coming up with a story outline, and she goes, but what if I write this and then it's awful and then my life is ruined? And I'm like, yeah, you should probably just quit. You're right.
You've gone so many steps ahead of where you need to be right now. Your life will get ruined one way or the other. You might as well just write today.
Yeah. And, you know, I think there are writers who are so it's possible to get lost in the other end and just love everything that you do and don't care if it actually means anything.
Yeah, I think so too. That's a good point.
Although I don't see as much of that. But that is a possibility. I know that was me when I was an undergrad. I'm a genius. Like, oh God, just make it stop. And so for me, it really comes down to this question of finding a way to live within that tension of creating something that means something, but not being so in love with structure or whatever it is that gives it meaning that you kill all the surprise and all the life out of the creativity. And I do think you're right. Like, if you have to fail in one direction, all right, fail in the direction of being more creative and less structured. Because the structure can often get fixed later, as it was with your book.
It's one of the nice things about working in pieces instead of in a longer sort of narrative. I've tried writing novels, and I've always just, they wander off into strange places, and I never finish them. But like working in little bits, I felt that doing it this way allowed me to be more in that sort of creative place because I wasn't worried about the narrative structure of the overall piece. You know, I didn't have to worry about that. I could just hang out in the weird place and allow for, you know, there's a lot of disjunction within the pieces. Like a friend of mine, Elisa, she's a poet, and we had this conversation once about poetry.
Is that Elisa Gabbert?
Elisa Gabbert, yeah. And she was talking about poetry as a way of thinking. Like there's a kind of thinking that can only happen in a poem. And for her, we were talking about lineation versus prose. But I do think that there's a kind of thinking that happens in poetry that when you allow yourself to not be sort of caught up in formal sort of structures and the way we sort of, I mean like sentence structure and narrative structure. If you don't get too caught up in that and you allow your brain to do what the brain does, which is different than how we talk and communicate to each other. There's some really interesting stuff that happens when your mind jumps around from image to image or word to word or whatever the case may be. And when you're in that sort of more creative place, I felt like in this book, because I was working in these little bits, I wasn't worried about the sort of overall thing. I was able to find really interesting places where I jumped from one thing to something entirely different without like having to account for the association, just allowing the association to be there itself. That was rambly. I don't know if what I said makes any sense.
Well, now I want to see a memoir called Hanging Out in the Weird Place. But
Hanging Out in the Weird Place, that's a good, no, be good.
You spoke earlier about how in editing, a lot of the parts that got deleted were the earliest scribbling and how when you had to push yourself to keep going when you didn't know how ended up being usually the more interesting things.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's also another thing experienced writers learn is the more you risk, and you could delete things if they don't work. You don't have to share them if they don't work. Mm-hmm. But as often as not, like those are the best parts of your writing. And so hopefully we get used to pushing ourselves.
Yeah.
And looking for the things that really seem either insightful or provocative in ways that don't seem cheap.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the Kulichev effects? Am I saying that right? Lev Kulichev, the Soviet film theorist back in the early part of early Soviet film. He did this experiment, and this was really sort of famous in film studies, where he had an image of an actor, a well-known actor, he just had a blank face and just filmed his face. And then he cut it with a bowl of soup and the audience saw it and said, oh, he's such a good actor. He looks so hungry. Then he cut it with a beautiful woman. You could see the lust in his face and then cut it with a corpse. And it's like, can you see him mourning? But the point Kulichev was making is that there's the relationship between the image is where the meaning is made. The association, when you put those two things together. And I've been really like thinking about that in terms of writing a lot, thinking about the relationship between seemingly disparate parts and how their association and their proximity to one another, how that can create meaning or experience, at least. Meaning and experience, I don't think are the same thing, but they're both things I look for in writing.
Well, and they can be not necessarily rational.
100%. Right, exactly.
So I took an acting class, and there was an exercise where we had to, I forget what we were supposed to express, but I was so tired, and I had so little energy, and probably depressed, and I just sat in the chair. And the acting teacher is like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "I'm depressed." And he goes, "You're doing nothing." He goes, "This is like the opposite of acting. There's nothing happening. Like, you are sharing nothing." And for me, the takeaway, yeah, I need to eat before that acting class. It starts at 6, and it's like, I don't want to eat at 5 or 5:30. But on the other hand, from 6 to 9, that's 3 long hours that I really need energy for. So it's like, ah, damn it. All right. So after that, I had to eat so that I would be able to do something. And, you know, like, acting is about risk. And it's like, if you're depressed and you method act, then you're just a lump. It's like, no, you have to. Mm-hmm. You have to try in order to be actually doing the thing. And it's like, if you're in this acting class, you actually have to do things. You can't just sit there in front of everybody going, yep, look at me, do nothing.
I run the theater program here where I teach also. And when I'm working with young actors, that's one thing. You would just have to want something. They have to try to get something. That's what it's about. It's like actors get so hung up. I think this is my personal take, but I think especially young actors are so concerned about expressing emotion. And that's not very interesting, I don't think. But what's interesting is if someone happens to express emotion, that's fine. But what's interesting is they're trying to get something. They're trying to accomplish something or trying to make something happen. And that's what's interesting. If they're trying to achieve something, there's an obstacle in their way. And how are they struggling to do that thing? And then, you know, I think good actors just externalize their internal lives. And they train. That's what method acting does, in my opinion, too. It also trains your body to react honestly to imaginary stimuli. So the emotion is a side effect of trying to get something, trying to achieve an objective, as they say.
But what I also love about the potential for acting anyway is just how, like, where does the meaning come from? Because it's possible for all of it to be irrational, and yet it still means something. Mm-hmm. Have you seen the new David Lynch short film with the monkey?
Yes, I love that film.
David Lynch plays a detective in this sort of noirish story where he's interrogating a monkey, and the dialogue, kind of like John Ashbery, like, there are times when it feels like noir dialogue, and it kind of makes sense. If you overlook that it's a monkey, it kind of makes sense. And then the dialogue veers off and gets crazy. Mm-hmm. And then the most infuriating thing of all is then it kind of winds its way back into making sense. And, like, the monkey's acting is fine, and David Lynch's acting is fine, and the whole thing is holding together, even though there's no reasonable way it holds together, except both the actors, and I don't know how they got the monkey to work. I don't know if that's completely CGI. I don't know if that was a monkey that they, you know, manipulated digitally later. I don't know what the story is.
I feel like they just superimposed a human mouth on top of the monkey.
But, you know, like, it's toying with our sense of reason, but it feels like it makes sense.
David Lynch is one of my heroes. And I think in large part because a lot of what we've been talking about today is the ways we sort of access creativity. And I think that's sort of what he's all about. He uses transcendental meditation. He thinks that's sort of the key. But whatever it is, I love that he trusts intuition in art. He doesn't default to things that have already existed. It's also why he really resists explaining his films. If people come up and say, well, what really is Mulholland Drive about? What really happened in the third season of Twin Peaks? He won't answer. He'll say, you tell me. I honestly think it's because he really doesn't even maybe know entirely. Like, he probably has some ideas about it, but he knows that it's just right. He knows that what he's creating is right and it works and it's creating the experience he wants to create. But to try to reduce it to something that you could really articulate easily takes away its power. This is true of poetry too. I tell this to my beginning poetry students all the time. If I could write next to a poem what the poem means, then just write that. I'd rather see the essay, you know?
Yeah.
But what a poem does is it does something, right? Yeah. I think Lynch is just the master of trusting intuition, trusting his own creativity, and not falling into just sort of boring, cliched tropes that we watch every day in media or we read so often.
Or even the surreal tropes that we see in his own work. Like, I don't feel like his work is interchangeable.
That's a really great point. Right.
I think he keeps his mouth shut until he has something to say. I'm not entirely sure about Twin Peaks: The Return.
I love it.
I think half of it was brilliant, and at least a third of it, I think, is too silly for its own good.
Oh, man. I would love to have a long conversation about Twin Peaks: The Return. I have to say that episode 8, though, is one of the most wonderful things I've watched in my opinion.
That was the Nevada one with a bomb?
Yeah.
No, if that was the whole series, like, I would say it's a masterpiece. Like, it's an absolute masterpiece.
Yeah.
I feel like, let's try and have the shorter Twin Peaks: The Return conversation, which is this. Okay, so the plot that we expect from Twin Peaks season 2, leading into anything heading forward, is Agent Cooper is stuck in the Black Lodge. He needs to get out to stop the doppelganger, either from killing Annie, although apparently that happened, although nobody seems to think it's a big deal, which, like, what the fuck happened with that? But you've got this doppelganger who looks like Agent Cooper creating havoc in our world, and Agent Cooper needs to get back to stop that. And what the doppelganger's ultimate goal is, we don't quite know. I think it's just he doesn't want to go back into the Black Lodge. He wants to keep out and have fun. I think that's what he's up to.
Sounds about right.
So that's the story we expect. And he ruins the gratification of that story at every turn and makes it the most miserable story to follow, in which it takes him a long time to get out of the Black Lodge. And then he has amnesia once he's out. And he's rendered into this bizarre alien child who can only speak by repeating phrases someone else just said.
The Dougie character.
The Dougie character. But somehow the Black Lodge is giving him hints about how to do good things towards his own goal. And it's like, so that Agent Cooper doesn't even have any agency once he's out until the very... So I think all of that was meant to completely punish us for wanting a reasonable solution to maybe the best cliffhanger in the history of TV.
That's a good point.
But by almost any measure, there shouldn't have been that last episode of The Return, which then, okay, once he stops the doppelganger, what happens? And what happens is so bizarre, and I think that's the story David Lynch really wanted to tell, which is what happens when you've done all the right things and nothing is actually fixed, and things might actually be a lot worse, and Agent Cooper now can't even get back to our world or the Black Lodge, and is stuck having half-solved a problem with no tools to do anything else about it. And I thought, like, that was brilliant and eerie.
Yeah.
But half of it, I think David Lynch was just punishing us for wanting a reasonable conclusion to the original Twin Peaks.
I think that's fair, but I also think I don't think that we should expect a reasonable conclusion from David Lynch.
I just don't think it needed to take that long to frustrate us.
Okay, fair. I mean, I enjoy it all along the way. Because you're right. I actually love the way that it ended. And I didn't love it when I was watching it when it came out. I was very frustrated at the end of The Return. But as I've rewatched it and thought about it, I'm like, I think this is actually right. It kind of has that Mulholland Drive ending with it. But I'm just thinking a little bit about Paul Auster, who I see that you've talked to him before. Yep. And I think that one of the things that he does so well in fiction is he does exactly that. He sets you up expecting a kind of certain kind of payoff that we're really used to in traditional narratives. And then he just leaves them. He'll leave it alone. And you're sitting there going, but what about the thing in the locker? Or what, you know, and I love that about Paul Auster. I think it's just, it reminds us in the postmodern way that we're reading a book. Oh yeah.
But also maybe that these story structures are addictive and maybe part of the cause of our own suffering. I have to accomplish this.
I love that.
And if we don't assess, why do you want this? Like, who is this serving? You know, then, but I think Mark Maron at one point said, yeah, maybe comedy is a dream. That's just, you know, like a car driving over my body and killing it. Like maybe, maybe comedy isn't such a good thing. And, you know, one of the strengths of his comedy is the sense of the absurdity that was his chosen profession. I don't think that works for every comedian, but I think that was a key for his honesty and his sense of, you know, kind of deconstructing, what are we even doing here?
Mm-hmm.
Watching comedy. Is it about dick jokes or is it about this angry Drew scurrying into the half-empty comedy room after 20 years of being in the business?
Yeah. Yeah.
Paul Auster also, I think of his movie Smoke and Augie with his, right? He takes a photograph of the same corner every day. And so that's kind of like your project where it's this meditative thing. And like, he's the cigar store owner and is he a creative person? Not professionally.
Right.
But in spirit.
There's something about that returning to that same thing every day and thinking through it. And yeah, I've always loved that little sequence in that film. I was thinking about that actually when I was working on this. I recall I sent a link to a YouTube clip of that actual clip from the film to Julie when we were doing that workshop. Because I was thinking about that sort of process that he went through. And it's just like, in that case, I love the noticing. Just thinking about it, looking and seeing and noticing.
Yeah, the writer is trying to like brush through it. He's like, nope, don't do that. Slow down, slow down. Mm-hmm. I wonder, it's a maybe interesting question. Does Paul Auster lead on story a little more in that than he does elsewhere? I think it's a little less frustrating, even though he takes his time in Smoke.
Right.
But,
well, of course, cinema, it's a whole team of people working together with a lot more money and stuff like that too. So there are other voices involved in the story.
So what are your challenges is you had to come up with things to say about the word "and" more than once?
Yeah, there's a lot of "ands" in there. The "ands" are kind of my favorite ones, or they're among them anyway. Each one is a little different. It's kind of fun to think of what that word does and how experience or things we've seen or thought about, thoughts, images, how these things aggregate. I think that aggregation is kind of what the "ands" are often about. Things just keep collecting in our experiences.
Well, and more than once, you kind of do this sort of semiotic daisy chain. You're like this and that, and then that, and this other thing, and this other thing. And it's so simple. And yet the things that you're connecting are surprising enough, and then it keeps going and in an almost purer way than John Ashbery. You're deliberately going, okay, these aren't sentences. These are just two nouns plus the conjunction and a whole series of fragments, just putting these things together. And the meaning, I think, is really stimulating and beautiful. And it's, you know, like, I'm a blue collar guy, so I love the word gimmick. You know, when you have gimmicks that work, it's so beautiful. And so, yeah, I think those work really well, even though if someone said, oh, you got to read this piece, this guy, he's writing about the word and he does this, I would go, why is that amazing? Like, on the face of it, I wouldn't predict that I would really find resonance with that work. And yet I did. So I endorse you loving those bits in the book because it over-delivered anything I expected out of the word "and."
Oh, well, thanks. I love that those stood out to you. it just also goes to show that when you're doing a project like this, it's not always the most interesting words that produce the most interesting thoughts. Well, in my opinion, like this is me looking back on the project from a distance. That's because that's why I can look at it and have these sort of like value judgments on some of what I've written.
Or you discover that words you take for granted are actually pretty interesting if you just slow down.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So
yeah,
this was your attempt to sort of get your creative self back, reclaim it from the academic void. I say that lovingly of academics, kind of, sort of. And so I guess I've got an observation and a question. And so the observation is writing prompts and writing regimens like the one that you undertook are underrated, I think. If we have naive, like undergrad creative writers, and we say, okay, let's all do this, they may just launch into it with a sense of glorious fun. That would be exactly the thing we would hope. But I think a lot of writers, if they start to think of themselves as serious, it's like they're above that. And the older I get, the less above that I become, I know. And I think it has to do with that sense of, yeah, I have a novel out. I teach creative writing. I'm official, damn it. Like, I'm bona fide, which means I have to create products. And once you have that mindset, you're kind of this purveyor of dead things.
Yeah.
Or at least that starts to weigh down whatever it is you're working on. And so when I have a writing prompt, like it's happened several times where it's like, okay, I just joined a writing group for a night and they're like, all right, this is what we're doing. I'm like, hot damn. All right. And I produce something I like that I had no premonition was in there or that it wasn't on my mind. So I think that we undervalue how great these prompts can be, even when it comes to producing final products, I think because our expectations are so low. And I think maybe more experienced writers appreciate that more than ambitious writers who just want to be famous now, damn it.
Yeah, for sure.
But I also would like to know your thoughts, one, about, you know, the utility of this, but also the long-term effects of reclaiming your creative self from the academic void, and if this led to a happier creative life, long-term.
Well, I mean, absolutely. What it did was, by engaging in a purely creative project in the midst of that, when I was working on the draft of this, it reminded me of what is important to me. It reminded me of how my brain works. It reminded me of what I sort of wanted to accomplish. I've been lucky since then in that I have a job at a liberal arts school in Maryland, and I might be leaving and going to Phoenix and, I don't know, working at Starbucks or something soon.
That's happening a lot in education these days.
Yeah, yeah. It's cool. I haven't been writing as much as I would like because I've been really busy with job stuff. But the cool thing is I'm not in a research school, so I don't have the sort of institutional pressures to keep doing scholarly work. My job is really focused on teaching. I go to conferences periodically and I write some articles here and there. But I've been here 6 years and I haven't had any desire to write a monograph or something, you know. But I write a lot of cool essays and I write plays and I write poems, and I realize that's what I want to do, whether it's within academia or outside of it. And I'm glad I got my PhD. I'm glad I have it because it's afforded me opportunities that I wouldn't otherwise have. But starting this project at the end of that PhD program made me realize, like I said, what's important to me and what I think is important to our culture, frankly. I think the creative work is more valuable. Well, not more valuable, but what I can offer.
You're allowed to say that here.
I think there are scholars whose work is immensely more valuable than anything I've ever done. But for what I'm able to produce and put into the world, I feel like my creative work is, that's what I feel is where I do my good stuff, my good thinking. So yeah, I made that realization then. And I've maintained it. And now as a teacher, I look at my job as providing opportunity and guidance for other people to be creative. That's what I do. I try to create opportunities for students to think differently, to explore different ways of expressing themselves. And that to me is really satisfying.
Well, that is the show for this week. I would like to thank Aaron Angelo, Abby Beckel and Kathleen Rooney, Samantha Nickerson for editing this episode, and of course, our great sponsor, Scribophile. If you are enjoying this show, please do spread the word on social media, and if you haven't done so yet, review the show over at Apple Podcasts or wherever it is you're doing your streaming. Don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including Perfect Advice from Dr. Perfect, comic book reviews by Drew Barth, and reviews of Schlock Film by Jeff Schuster. All right, gang, until next time, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
Never mind, John. Pass me the bottle.
A while back, John King endowed the Museum of Schlock and tasked me, Jeff Schuster, with curating the bugger. Each week, I curate one more entry into this proud genre of film. I think. Truth is, I'm really not sure what schlock is, but my writing about it is sublime. Read it every Friday at thedrunkenodyssey.com.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.
Sailor Jerry, only you understand me.